By dismantling the myth of history as progress, it is possible to uncover a subterranean history that reveals the darker side to the Enlightenment. This other history, which has been repressed, is one of instinct, desire, pleasure, and suffering. In short, a history of the body. This body that Adorno and Horkheimer write about in a section of the appendix of their critique of Enlightenment rationality stands alone and away from the main body of their text, Dialectic of Enlightenment. It has been set apart purposefully because it doesn't quite fit within their schema. It is excessive. The body they refer to is perhaps similar to the one that Marx referred to in Capital, first published in 1867, in his explication of the transformation of the working day between the 14th and 17th centuries. He told us that in its blind, unrestrainable passion, its werewolf hunger for surplus labor, capital oversteps not only the moral, but even the merely physical maximum bounds of the working day. It usurps the time for growth, development, and healthy maintenance of the body. It steals the time required for the consumption of fresh air and sunlight. It higgles over a mealtime, incorporating it where possible with the process of production itself, so that food is given to the laborer as a mere means of production, as coal is supplied to the boiler, grease and oil to the machinery. So the body is used up and replenished unless it exceeds capital's demands. Is that okay? But is that very loud?
Try again. Okay. So I'm beginning with a quote from the Dialectic of Enlightenment, but it's actually not included in the main body of their text. By dismantling the myth of history as progress, it is possible to uncover a subterranean history that reveals a darker side to the Enlightenment. This other history, which has been repressed, is one of instincts, desire, pleasure, and suffering. In short, a history of the body. This body that Adorno and Horkheimer write about in a section of the appendix of their critique of Enlightenment rationality stands alone and away from the main body of their text, Dialectic of Enlightenment. It has been set apart purposefully because it doesn't quite fit within their schema. It is excessive. This body they refer to is perhaps similar to the one that Marx referred to in Capital, first published in 1867, in his explication of the transformation of the working day between the 14th and 17th centuries. He told us that, quote, in its blind, unrestrainable passion, its werewolf hunger for surplus labor, capital oversteps not only the moral, but even the merely physical maximum bounds of the working day. It usurps the time for growth, development, and healthy maintenance of the body. It steals the time required for the consumption of fresh air and sunlight. It higgers over a mealtime, incorporating it where possible with the process of production itself, so that food is given to the labourer as a mere means of production, as coal is supplied to the boiler, grease and oil to the machinery. Unquote. So the body is used up and replenished unless its owner exceeds capital's demands. Marx adds to this, quote, "The overworked die off with a strange rapidity, but the places of those who perish are instantly filled, and a frequent change of persons makes no alteration in the scene." End quote. Marx shows us that the traces of historical suffering of a European, and it is, he's talking about a European surplus population at this point, if we are able to understand the processes by which people die before the end of their life, so to speak, they might reveal the ultimate expression of capital's morbidity. As it is human labor power that produces surplus for capital, it is also human life that suffers the effects of this process of evisceration and the deadening of the human body by capital's machinations. So, sorry for all of these men, but I just wanted to start with this history. Turning on our heel with the elision of a particular oppression of women from Marx's account, more recently in Caliban and the Witch from 2004, and so after her involvement with the feminist movement and her time in Nigeria working in education, Silvia Federici attempts to rewrite the history of the transition from feudalism to capitalism using the concept of primitive accumulation from the standpoint of the woman's rebellious body assigned to the figure of the prostitute or the witch. Very briefly, I will summarize her argument. Through this historical investigation into the sexual division of labor, Federici connects the vilification and banning of prostitution and the expulsion of women from guilds and organized workplaces in the 16th century with the creation of the housewife and the reconstruction of the nuclear family. So the locus of the production of labor power, as the locus for the production of labor power, by which I mean future workers. Federici makes an analogy between the factory as a site of struggle for this waged worker mentioned above, as in Marx, and the female body. The female body, she reveals, is the site of intense hyper-exploitation on the part of the state, capital, and men, and is differentiated as the body of the bearer of future labor power for proletarian women, most often as the owners of a potential commodity that in this history begins to have no value. Instead, it becomes reproductive or unpaid labor power belonging in the home, thus highlighting the particular historical nature of oppressions, and thus informing us that things can be changed. So during the late 1980s and through to the 1990s, it seems as if a whole academic and art industry emerged around studies that also concerned a kind of new obsession with the body. And some people have claimed that much of this literature turns away from the old laboring body and towards a new erotic, libidinal, and identified body. Thus reproducing this mind-body dualism that so many people are trying to collapse, as the body is severed from the mind is shunned. In my paper, I aim to address this development in relation to the field of art, and I'm going to talk now about an understanding of art emerging also from Adorno. So now I turn to 1970, when Theodore Adorno's last major work, Aesthetic Theory, was published after his death in 1969 and so remains incomplete. I'm interested in asking what remains pertinent to us in Adorno's concept of autonomous art and why it might still be radical for thinking about contemporary art. And I guess by contemporary art, I mean also art after, since 1960 or 1958. So not just in the last decade or so. In Aesthetic Theory, Adorno writes, "The artwork's autonomy is indeed not a priori, but the sedimentation of a historical process that constitutes its concept. Art is qualified by a historical claim in that it is created under the conditions of bourgeois capitalist society, with an ambiguity whereby there is no other art than autonomous art, and this is modern art. In other words, more than a historically determined argument is being made here. Art's double character allows for, firstly, the claim that art comes into its own, that it becomes art in this long passage to modernity, and secondly, for a structural claim about art itself. Adorno's logic about what can and cannot be considered art, which seems very exclusionary now, but I guess it's also interesting to see what he meant then and how we can question it, means that art must keep attempting to escape its own concept in order to remain as art. This is the movement of art's de-aestheticization, known also as the dialectic of art and anti-art. This de-aestheticization pertains to art's expanding idea of itself. Central to the question of the body as material in art is, for me, this notion of de-aestheticization or de-arting, the artwork becoming less and less like art, or art as we know it, and the intensified closeness of proximity and power that capital holds over the human body in ever more concealed ways, as we see now with new technologies and so on. During these years when Adorno was writing aesthetic theory, actionism also came to life in Japan, Europe, and America, developing out of and responding to various artistic movements, Dada, Surrealism, Touchism, Abstract Expressionism, happenings and fluxus. With actionism, art changes its course. Something is dented in Adorno's understanding of art, and it is perhaps remodeled. In Adorno's schema, art makes a claim to the objective autonomy, which is a kind of corollary to the subjective autonomy that that people make with the Enlightenment. So I also want to ask, does this shift coincide with a weakening possibility to be an autonomous subject under capitalism now? The pessimist might suggest so, I'm not sure. What is the contribution that explicitly feminist projects make to this transforming status of art? What are the historical conditions of possibility for such works? And what in them, if anything, do we still find to be alive to us today? I will briefly outline some of the emerging and not so feminist practices before turning to the work of Valley Export. So, going back in time slightly and travelling to Paris, on June 5th, 1958, in Robert Godet's apartment on Ile Saint-Louis, Yves Klein began to experiment with what he called living brushes. He invented a technique where he took a nude woman and instead of painting her in his studio, he put her to work. As his work amused, this naked woman was covered in blue paint. She was then instructed to leave, via a series of rotating movements, the prints of her own body on a sheet of paper set on the floor, until the paper was entirely submerged in this blue paint, resulting in a blue monochrome. In Vienna in 1964, Otto Muhl developed an idea of material actions defined in his manifesto as when, quote, a person is not treated as a person but as a body. The body, things are not viewed as objects for our purpose but have all been radically removed from them. Everything is understood as form. The human being is not seen as a human being, a person, but as a body with certain properties. Material action extends reality. End quote. Muhl didn't understand his characters as characters he could use like Yves Klein, but he still used them. In Leda and the Swan, performed at the Perrinet Cellar in Vienna on the 20th of August, and filmed here by Kurt Krenn. These are just stills from the documentation, which he then turned into a film. Various things would happen between Leda and Leonardo, these two characters, that were set up by Muhl, like treating her body to salad, oil, jam, flour, or bed feathers in erotically charged ways. These things were meant to occur as if in dreams with a similar kind of spontaneity. Muhl later characterized material actions as, I quote, arising from the destruction of painting, easel painting. It is painting that has grown beyond the surface of everything. It's grown beyond the surface of everything, can be used as the material. The material action's effect comes about through destruction. This destruction is directed against the slimy ideas with which we patch together our reality. In 1961, across the Atlantic, and with a different intention, Piero Manzoni conceived of living sculpture, signing off bodies with different coloured receipts. Red would indicate the whole person as a work of art, yellow for a limb and green for a body, that would only be art temporarily. As an opposite of actionism, living sculpture describes the articulation of a leap from life into art, a leap from life into death. This coincided historically with the intensification of Walter Benjamin's idea of mechanical reproduction, as well as the creation of credit markets and the production of swathes of consumer durables, the saturation of the marketplace with new objects. Life, in this sense, was the radical other to the conveyor belt of constantly accumulative reproduction, but at the same time, this life, as depicted here, crawled into art's darkness in the museum and pointed to something else, art's precarious condition, continuation. America's living sculpture was the other to a deep sense of loss felt in post-war Europe, the emptiness felt by a continent in mourning. These avant-garde male artists were, in this transitional moment, still treating women as a thing to use, as the surface of an expanded painting or an actual live sculpture. At this point in the 60s, like in Western culture in general, it was still very difficult for women to enter the art world as equal subjects to men. Some men also protested the category women artists because, some women also protested this category of women artists because they didn't want to affirm a marginal position, instead wanting recognition on an equal par to their male contemporaries. In 1965, Peter Weibel said, "Centered in the body and in this world, the body is the artistic medium. The human body itself is the work of art, the material." This gesture of taking the material as the body as material typified Viennese actionism, as we have seen with Moore. Surrounded by the Viennese actionists, Valley Export began making her works. I'm sure you're maybe all familiar with some of her work. I don't know, I'll go into it in more detail now. So, often but not always in collaboration with Peter Weibel, a pronounced difference between the works of Export and Weibel and the rest of the actionists was their attitude towards reproductive technology, the stills and film and video camera. This difference has been described by Weibel as their suspicion that reproductive technology might draw them by proxy too close to the medium of painting. It would do this by recreating the same kind of frame that they wanted to explode with their actions and interventions into life. In almost everything one reads about Valley Export, a similar phrase to this appears near the beginning of the text, following. In the late 1960s, Walt Rode Hollinger took the name Valley and appropriated Export from a cigarette packet, which is in this photograph here. She smoked smart Export, self-branding as an artist and a woman, refusing the familial names of men, which had been allocated her after birth and then marriage. The works that she makes are framed by her name. If we consider the verb use of Export as pertaining to the idea of sending out commodities, then the surname Valley chose to replace her paternal names is both banal in its common use and interesting for me for what it points dialectically towards, commodity or produce in its noun form and the act of sending the commodity to market in its verb form. This belongs to the continuation of another male Duchamp, so Valley Export could be a ready-made artist. In a way, I think she's interested in this contradiction. But the idea of export, of bringing out, has a third meaning. It is related to the possibility of self-determination and transformation, more specifically the potential of struggle and the necessary struggle that women faced and continue to face in overcoming their oppression. This first act of naming is depicted as a black and white photograph from 1968. Here, her hand holds the box as it looms into our view. The box is defaced with the artist's face imposed in the middle, replacing an image of a defunct world. Inscribed around the edge are the words Semper et Ubique, Immer und Überall, meaning always and everywhere in German, in Latin and German. Valley is written over smart as the top banner. A cigarette tips out of her mouth and her eyes gaze downwards. The image breathes strength for new women entering the workplace and making a perhaps unconscious articulation of the self as entrepreneur, exporter for herself. And I think this is kind of also responding to a move away from the housewife, the woman confined in the home. So this is a kind of historical moment that she's responding to. So from commodity to technology, and a familiar thematic of exports works, is pain. In the well-known The Body in Pain, a book by Elaine Scarry, she claims that pain has no particular object. Pain cannot be expressed through language and therefore resists objectification. Pain stands in for the unspeakable and inexpressible for Scarry. This pain can only be alleviated through imagination, through the making of the world. I think she means that cultural artifacts are both a relief from and an extension of the body. These things extend as part of our body, and in so doing, free the body from some discomfort, also allowing us to enter into a larger plane of self-extension. And for Freud, which I'm going to turn to this because it brings us back to Valley Export, there is another way of understanding the body's self-extension into the world through the prism of tools. So this is Freud. With every tool, man is perfecting his own organs, whether motor or sensory. He is removing the limits of their functioning. Motor power places gigantic forces at his disposal, which, like his muscles, he can employ in any direction. Thanks to ships and aircraft, neither water nor air can hinder his movements. By means of spectacles, he corrects defects in the lens of his own eye. By means of the telescope, he sees into the far distance, and by means of the microscope, he overcomes the limits of visibility set by the structure of his retina. In the photographic camera, he has created an instrument which retains the fleeting visual impressions, just as the gramophone disc retains the equally fleeting auditory ones. Both are at bottom materializations of the power he possesses of recollection, his memory. With the help of the telephone, he can hear at distances which would be respected as unattainable, even in a fairy tale. Writing was in its origin the voice of an absent person, and the dwelling house was a substitute for the mother's womb, the first lodging, for which, in all likelihood, man still belongs, and in which he was safe and felt at ease. Obviously, it's ridiculous that he only talks about men, but I guess it's anachronistic. And it stands in for humans. Valley Export writes about this passage in an essay called The Real and Its Double, The Body, claiming that it contributes to the development of an adequate theory of the relationship of the body to technology. Freud's suggestion here is that tools are part of the human body's expansion, also revealing and confounding its limitations, as we've seen. Tools are part of the natural organs and artificial prosthesis. And that this is the case is the statement that Valley Export addresses in her investigation of the meaning of the female body and its relation to capital's reproduction and reproductive technology. And she's thinking of cameras and auditory mediums, but also in general tools. Working from these ideas, she denaturalizes the body's capacity for the reproduction of human life, contra Federici. But in doing so, she presents a paradox. On the one hand, Freud signifies the body's sex determinations in his ideas of femininity and what a woman is. There is a kind of biological, even if psychically understood, idea of men and women, or girls and boys. So on the other hand, this theory of technology allows for a broader shift towards a natural historical argument revealing other means of understanding the uses of tools as belonging to and as expanding bodily functions. Tools are thus understood as expansions, perfections, and transgressions of the human organism. much like the Freudian body, which is made up of functional orifices and organisms. So there is also another angle that Export takes in relation to this point. And I quote her, "The house replaces the mother's womb not only because the embryo has become an adult, but because civilization begins to replace and repress nature in the imposition of the reality principle. Culture also always means the civilization of the body, the technical extension and expansion of the body," end quote. Export's understanding of the body also rested on the Freudian notion of culture, which informed other people, for example, Walter Benjamin's prognosis that culture is always also the product of a certain barbarism. So there's no like pure culture which is untainted by capitalism or the world in general. Export also argues that via culture, the human body in its penetration by technological processes and with the development of the ego also becomes external to the self. The body becomes part of the external world, alienated from the subject. The body is also the prime target of instrumental reason, as object among objects of exchange par excellence. The body is fully constructed through rationalization and technological modernization. At this point, her resolve in this essay is to let the body and form dissolve. So she's kind of, maybe slightly worryingly, ends up in this position of no kind of possibility. There's no possibility beyond like hysteria or anorexia or these things which historically women have either been pathologized to kind of to do or represent, or well, she sees a certain power in that. Anyway, we could go back to that later. So this is the last section of my paper. In Remote Remote, which is a film from 1973, I can show a clip.
Wait for the speakers to be turned on.
Are you in the right one?
Yeah.
It worked before. Oh yeah, great, okay. Okay, I'll just show you that poster. So, Remote Remote from 1973 was filmed as a performance in front of an audience that was then impressed onto celluloid. Through all of its moments, it works on identity, explores identity in its formation, asks what does identity mean and where does identity happen. This film begins by showing the performer sitting in a chair in front of a blown up black and white photograph of two abused children with a bowl of milk in her lap. This information circulates around it because of it we know that these children were wrenched from their parents because of abuse allegations. the image was found in a police station. On the question of identity, the film seems to suggest severance. As most theories of early child development state, in our bourgeois capitalist world, the child develops out of an original state of oneness with the mother womb world and into a painful sense of their own separateness. The child is then faced with a paradoxical desire to return to that state of oneness and to become an autonomous person, to make the distinction between self and not self, to separate themselves from that and to individuate. In Remote, there is a drum roll, a beat around which the action happens. The rhythm provides dreaded continuity. Valley Export sits on a chair in front of this photograph. The camera and the one standing behind it identifies these three figures, the two children and the performer, by moving between each of their pupils. Each character finds its connection to the other's eye with an X-Acto knife that looks to the knife used to cut and splice film. Valley Export cuts into her cuticles. The camera eye rests on this act of mutilation. As the ends of her fingers collect blood, we are led further into this destruction. Is the knife a symbol of language and this act of cutting, which happens so frequently in her artwork on film, but also within and as part of constructing film, cutting through film, cutting through history and politics, constructing, splicing together? Is it here an act of externalization? Is self-mutilation registering the inner mutilation that comes from being born into civilization with its laws of renunciation and sacrifice, and then growing up, perhaps becoming educated or working a menial job? It is at this moment historically that identity struggles have already burst open the political spheres. With the civil rights movement and the women's movement, the colonial wars and so on, the objects in this performance film, the photograph of the children, the performer, the milk, her fingers and the knife, and the celluloid, the skin of the artwork, create a constellation that reaches into interior space, cuts the skin in order to access that inaccessible space that only through pain, through externalization of the life world can possibly be accessed. In her words, quote, women have long preserved and sealed off their damaged identity under the emblem of pain's deformations. To prevent submission from becoming woman's eternal destiny, the wounds of actual historical submission to men must be unhesitatingly revealed. This avowal, this confession publique, will free women from the ills men have inflicted on them. That's from her kind of manifesto. The cutting of the skin around the nails is part of the construction of jarring images that connote and condemn religiosity in Vienna, Catholicism, and normality, or rather, the normal images of the children cut through the quasi-religious images of pain, pain and life, milk and blood, sex and death. The destruction of the artist's hand also reveals the limits placed upon women in their historical expulsion from the workplace and into their imposed role as mother, housewife, the work of the woman also into their reintegration into the wage relation. So there's this kind of limit question. The use of the material milk, which speaks of a vitality of life, of need and of attachment, of cathexis, of warmth and nutrition, also speaks to the separateness, also speaks to the first separation of infant from mother that I mentioned earlier, that occurs in their first days of life. After a while, milk, which might evoke a warm and nutritious life world in the person, might then grow up to find a substitute in their sexuality. This representation of the experience of suffering and pain with reproductive technology that records so that the absolute representation, the result of the light and chemicals, can be seen, then the fixation of the event is what makes the duration of the work of art obsolete, but also what makes it timeless without end, because it can be played over and over again. On the one hand, so as she told us, the wounds of actual historical submission to men must be unhesitatingly revealed through these artworks. And on the other hand, the artworks through their construction are wholly illusory. And so there's a kind of paradox there. In a late essay called Transparencies on Film, Theodore Adorno posed a number of questions regarding the relationship that film had to art and to society, but also with regard to its aesthetic character. He writes, "Film suggests the equation of technology and technique. The cinema has no original, which is then reproduced on a mass scale. The mass product is the thing itself. Adorno suggests that film can never produce a pure aesthetic because, like, nothing can. But because it is unable to do away with representation, and for this reason, some people would probably argue that now, but it's interesting for the point he makes. And for this reason, there will always be something sociological in film, which is interesting to me. So, according to Adorno, film resembles the subjective mode of experience and is akin to the construction of interior images that are discontinuous, also perhaps like dreams. And he writes, as the objective recreation of this kind of experience, film may become art. So can the scene that Valley Export produces, which is mechanically reproduced of psychic pain and mutilation, a public confession, point towards the negative image of a world without pain? Perhaps. What is latent in Valley Export's works and made explicit in her name are the ways in which the female body has been shaped, determined, contorted, and configured by the dominant external gaze, as well as the division of labor, chronically over centuries that preceded the technology that she uses, which has also participated in reducing her to an image. Her performance films work on patriarchal male power, the structures that have preserved the gender division of representation from Dionysius to Christ, in representations of pleasure and pain that she's kind of engaging with in the 70s, less so later on. They also include their own conditions of possibility and historical feasibility. I mean the possibility of an artwork that considers capitalist patriarchal domination of women, that works on kind of active self-recognition. So to prevent this submission from becoming woman's eternal destiny, but also destabilizing the category woman in terms of a kind of a thing to affirm, because it's also, according to her, something which might not exist and which already has been constructed ideologically. When they were made, they attempted, when these works were made, and she also says that she could never make them after this point because the world changed and she changed in relation to it. But when they were made, they attempted to hold up to society an image of what it couldn't bear, although now, 41 years later, they seem paradoxically violent and tame because we see stuff like this all the time, but at the same time, there's something in them. The society they were speaking to was post-war Austria, where the image of the body was constructed through physical discipline to perfection, this kind of Nazi, because they really kind of embraced Nazification, and this idea of the kind of Greek heroic body was really prominent, and anything else was kind of excluded. The body is rendered visible in Marx's Capital as a labouring body, as we've seen before, as an instrument of the means of production. And in returning to that, I should also return to the Dialectic Enlightenment, where in a note they say, most mutilated of all is the relationship to the body. The body is bifurcated, they say, so, and this is me, the body is bifurcated and made abject or disposed of under capitalism and through philosophy by the division of labor into intellectual and manual. They say, love hate for the body colors the whole of modern culture. The body is scorned and rejected as something inferior, enslaved, and at the same time is desired as forbidden, reified, estranged. Only culture treats the body as a thing that can be owned. Only in culture has it been distinguished from the mind, the quintessence of power and command, as the object, the dead thing, the corpus. In humanity, self-abasement to the corpus, nature takes its revenge from the debasement of the human being to an object of power, to raw material. as labour power, as... And as we saw with Silvia Federici, this conflict is, quote, Federici, now staged within the person who is reconstructed as a battlefield where opposite elements clash for domination. The body is the condition of the existence of labour power, and it is also its limit. Valiexport's body is slightly different. It is marked as a new battlefield, a terrain where one might find a struggle for self-determination. This battlefield is a result of her historical situation, and it is a territory marked by all social life and apparatuses, including the camera eye. It is a culturally gendered body and a female body, but it's not restricted to being female. In her words, it is used as a code or a sign in a semantic way, never in a spiritual or biological way. It is, her words, the main sign which enables us to experience the power of history and history as a construction, making it, history, visible and consequently also changeable. So in Valiexport's works, the body, by being present but mediated, also reveals its very absence as it is abstracted from its owner, in a way. If that makes sense. But this body has also been linked to so she's not just in this field of imminence of being reduced to her body, it's also that there's this kind of question of mediation. But this body has also been linked to feminist struggles and the ways that women have been fixed by the body, struggles over contraception, against forced sterilization, the right to abortion, maternity rights, rape and self-defense, body image and sex work, which all have their basis in the idea that the body is one's property, and because that's the social conditions under which we live, and that one must have the right to choose what happens to it. These struggles also came about because until them, women and slaves, unlike men, had not had control over their bodies in the sense of this right to the body. These struggles are part of the paradoxical nature of the emancipation in and subordination to capital and the double nature of women's subjugation. When discussing the body, we are also required to consider capital's expansion and its proximity to all aspects of human life, as can be seen in new developments of biotechnology. So here, discussions of the emancipation of women and non-white peoples in terms of their integration into the wage relation is also their entanglement with the brutal and violent dehumanizing procedures of capitalism as this paradox plays out. And they're included in ways in which they weren't before, at least in the last century. So I just kind of conclude by saying that I think there is this strange hovering that she manages in some of these films, and there are more of them, to do, which is kind of dealing with this imminent space of corporeality, of like the woman's actual, what actually happens to women's bodies, and with all of the problems which are prescribed, such as essentialism and biologism and ahistoricity, this idea of like the eternal feminine. But at the same time, they also kind of work to undo these problems. So I would like to speculatively suggest that that these feminist works, within their engagement with technology and their consciousness of mediation, cut through any notion of pure immediacy of the body and go beyond it. So they include in and speak to pain and pleasure by interrogating the effects of domination and also dwelling on them by kind of thinking about what the commodification of women is and of people in general, but also kind of and of like external and internal pain. You know, she kind of deals a lot with sexuality and with these kind of processes. And yeah, the pain and pleasure that she inflicts upon herself, and by doing so also inflicts upon her audience, speak to the fragmentary nature of our contemporary experience. Thank you.